Craig Tindale, private investor and writer of the C. Tindale Substack. Thanks for joining me again. Welcome to The Competent Man.
Thanks for having me.
Craig, you know, I spoke with you last week and we had such an interesting conversation that I enjoyed so much that I immediately asked you to come back on. There's so much that we didn't get to in that first discussion. And I wanted to kind of flesh out more of these ideas, more of what you and I spoke about, let's say, off of the recording. Obviously, this is a new week. There's a bunch of stuff that happened between the last time you and I spoke and now. And I think we should take some time to speak about Iran and, let's say, what is most likely to be the next biggest dominoes to fall based upon what we could see happen here. So closing the Strait of Hormuz is always pointed to as a major risk factor. And in the 12-day war, the price of oil barely moved, as I remembered it, kind of signaling that the market didn't really see a risk of oil being stopped shipping out there. This time, oil is up something like 15% since the beginning of the conflict. So what would the downstream effects of oil ceasing to be shipped through the strait be?
Well, I'm trying to think of an analogy. You know, I guess this Strait of Hormuz is like the jugular vein or something like that. Sorry if I brutalize an analogy, but it's basically where most trade goes through, especially energy trade, but also a bunch of other things, you know, like the food for the people in the region. You know, I think I saw that yesterday there was a Saudi number that they have 4 to 6 weeks supply of food at any one time. And yeah, that's not to say they're going to starve to death, but it shows you the importance. You know, I saw another article yesterday, sulfuric acid used to refine copper. Almost all comes through the straits. And so it becomes interesting because, you know, 50% of Chinese oil comes through the straits. And we've got a large collection of estimates of what they've got stored. Some say 300 days, some say, you know, 100 days. Now, I'm not commenting on whether it's 100 days or 300 days, but people look at it a little simplistically because, you know, they say, well, you know, let's take the higher number, the 300 days. You know, they've got crude. Well, they also import $2.5 trillion worth of other stuff, and, you know, including the oil. And there's a lot of things, chemicals, et cetera. I think it was $48 billion worth of chemicals that they import. And you end up with this kind of golden screw concept, and or I'll call it the titanium bolt concept. I had a supercar for a while until I got bored with it. And one of the reasons I got rid of it is, you know, it lost its bolt out of its steering rack. And it was just a, you know, small titanium bolt. It was, I think, worth $86 Australian. So that's not even, you know, a lot of money in US dollar terms. I think it's about $45 in US dollar terms. But it took me 9 months to get it. So the whole car was in pristine condition with that single bolt stopping me driving it. I couldn't get it made. I looked at everything. I just had to wait for it. And I think that's a good analogy to use because, you know, the Straits of Hormuz is my titanium bolt. You know, you don't need to lose all factors. You just need to lose the important ones, and it's the combination. It's like you're losing the yeast if you're baking bread. You're still going to be able to make bread, but it's not going to taste very good. It's not going to rise, and it's not going to do any of the things you need it to do. People look at, for instance, gallium. We've got to build a mine, and we're going to secure the rights to produce gallium, and, you know, that's going to go into production in, say, 2 years. But if you don't have tantalum to go with it, you can't bake your cake, you can't make your bread, and you can extrapolate that out across about 60 different substances. And so what that means in the Straits of Hormuz sense is, okay, they've got a buildup of crude, they've got that in storage, but, you know, if you take the $400 billion worth of crude they import, you look at the other things, $48 billion worth of chemicals. So, you know, they can't distill crude. They can't refine crude. You know, they're limited in what they can do very much more quickly than the absolute storage indicates when you hear commentators saying they've got huge storage. Well, yeah, they've got huge storage, but they haven't got huge storage of anything, everything. So I think it starts to affect everyone. And I think it goes into a the classic, I call it the Dr. Strangelove, you know, the Stanley Kubrick movie, the idea that you've got a doomsday machine that if you're attacked, you know, you can take off the head of the Hydra, you can take the head of the snake off, but the rest of the body can keep fighting. And I think that's what we're finding, what we're seeing unfolding in Iran, is that, you know, the signature of some of these missiles and drone base, minimal. You only really pick them up, the radar, et cetera, when they start flying. And they're all hidden from view. So defense mechanism, that's, you say you can, you know, kill, I think they're up to about 70 leaders in the last few days. You can kill all the leaders and, you know, the kind of doomsday defense keeps popping up and shooting, but you know, ships in the Straits of Hormuz, and you know, it's very hard to get on top of it. So you know, it's very unclear. I wouldn't go into the predictions that other people do. I think certainty and war, like, you know, I grew up as a kid reading war history. And, you know, one of the things the first takes is, you know, predictions about what's going to happen. You know, the unknown unknowns in war means that you can't make predictions. You can't make confident forecasts about how things are going to unfold. You simply can't. You know, we don't know the first layer, second layer, third layer of what I'm calling the doomsday offense, the defense of the Iranians. You know, maybe there's nobody left and they still keep firing. Who knows? But the reality is, the economic thing is that they have taken the global economy hostage. And I think probably the strategy was, if we close down the global economy, it will force the rest of the world to deal with us and come to terms with us. It's kind of a strategy gone wrong.
So, Craig, the reason I wanted to ask that is because it, you know, this seems to be a good continuation of our last conversation. How dependent is China on the Strait of Hormuz as well? And do you think in some ways that this is maybe a strategic play by the US against China because of how dependent they are for their energy and many of their imports and exports, as you mentioned?
Well, the truth of it, we'll probably never know, or we'll know after the fact, but it seems coincidental that first it was Venezuela and what unfolded there in the securing of that crude to, you know, US refineries. And now we've got Iran. I think it's 2.4 million barrels per day come from the Russians overland and other Eastern Bloc countries. Then you've got the rest of their, I think, 11 million barrel demand, you know, coming from basically the Straits of Hormuz. And so I think Iran supplied 11%. I might have that wrong, but the rest of the Gulf in total, if you include Iran. So you start to see China in quite a difficult energy position if it doesn't, you know, including gas as well. They certainly haven't got that much gas stored. You start seeing them in a fairly difficult energy position very, very quickly because they can't get the gas, they can't get the oil. They become very interested in solving it. And it's an interesting kind of mirror of the rare earths situation. And so it makes you thoughtful. It makes you thoughtful about what they're trying to, you know, what the US is trying to do. If they can disrupt energy supplies and make China beholden on them for energy, and then you reverse that back and China makes the US beholden for rare earths and critical metals, you might get some kind of crazy balance and permanent peace. You know, fingers crossed, maybe I'm an optimist, but people are looking at it from that perspective. You know, there's a lot of people that get morally absolute in this process where they say, you know, we're trying to free the people of Iran, or you go the other way and say, you know, we've got no right under the UN to go into Iran. And the US, you know, that's arguable, though international law is a confusing topic because, you know, you can do things and you can't do things, and people automatically believe that it works like domestic law. And it doesn't work like domestic law, like it's got some big holes in it. The interesting aspect, if you go into it more thoroughly, is that what we're really looking for is geopolitical balance. We're looking for these two co-joined twins, these two great economies, superpowers of global government, to start cooperating with each other. And, you know, maybe the tension of, I guess, one having energy and the other one having a chokehold on rare earths might be the geopolitical balance that we get, that we need. And, you know, we come to some kind of begrudging peace between the parties. I don't think, you know, obviously both sides of them are in a decoupling type pathway. But, you know, I've always thought that there's realistic boundaries to how far they can take that decoupling. You know, they're awfully integrated to make an idea, to, you know, to take an idea of decoupling and make it absolute. I think the Chinese trade was nearly $1 trillion. And the American trade deficit was nearly $1 trillion, or the Western trade deficit was nearly $1 trillion with China. Like, really, you know, $2.4 trillion worth of imports from China. So they have to import $2.4 billion worth of stuff, and they're exporting, you know, more than that. Is decoupling just some kind of political idea that will never get completed? You know, it's all very white. People say it's the end of globalization. It's like saying it's the end of your arteries, you know. If you end your arteries, you die. But the flow of capital, the flow of trade, the flow of goods is gigantuan. And people talk about it as the end of globalization. I think we'll come to a midpoint. I think we took it too far. But the reality is, you know, I can't see them decoupling. They're not being very successful at it yet. Sure, American industrial investment is up 16%. It's growing, obviously. Onshoring is working in some contexts, but it's not working in other contexts. So I think we end up, I don't think it's necessarily bad news. And I think that's important people to understand that there's the hope of an ideal pathway here that might eventuate, you know, with the fight between the various AIs, you know, they might wrestle each other to truce. You know, our AI, the Western AI, is getting smarter almost as quickly as the Chinese, and the Chinese, you know, they're kind of leapfrogging each other. They're following an open source strategy, and we're following a proprietary strategy. But, you know, open source is going to be good for edge computing, and the proprietary strategy is going to be good for frontier computing. So, you know, maybe this is our pathway. Evolution is always robust and sometimes brutal. And why wouldn't we follow that kind of brutal, difficult pathway to find the new economy of the next world? I think the world is changing. Everyone agrees with that. I think there's a lot of doomsayers saying, well, it's changing for there. We're going through, you know, a level of perturbation, and it might even look dystopian for a while, but it doesn't mean it's the end. I'd encourage everyone to kind of get in view that it's going to be like Vietnam and all that kind of stuff. I just don't think we know. You know, there's no boots on the ground yet. You know, maybe they can close this kind of doomsday machine of Iran off. I know a lot of Iranians. You know, I've got three very good Iranian friends, and they seem awful happy about it. So I'm happy for them. I hope it all works out.
Well, it's interesting to consider, as you said, maybe as these trade routes and choke points balance out, it's really interesting to me to consider that, especially because I took your advice and over the weekend I read Unrestricted Warfare that you had suggested last week. So the idea that the West versus Iran, or, you know, the two, let's say, main combatants in this battle are fighting a far more multi-pronged battle than you would be considering if we include economic warfare, if we include trade and all of these different pieces of the puzzle. It's a far deeper puzzle to need to solve for and to properly get a grasp of in order to try to actually understand and try to see where that balance lies.
Yeah, it's a multi unrestricted warfare is a brilliant book in a conceptual sense, because it shows you both an integration path and a warfare path, and maybe they're one and the same over time toward, you know, the next evolution, the next substrate of humanity. The, you know, economic warfare, we talked, I think, last week about state capitalism, and everybody, I guess, correlates state capitalism with communism. And so, you know, you and I thought about state capitalism as a form of communism that obviously free market enterprise would beat us. That was in my mind. And then you start to think to yourself, well, maybe state capitalism is just one manifestation of state capitalism. You know, if you look at Alexander Hamilton's ideas, he had a form of state capitalism that involved freedom. So maybe we're looking at an unhealthy and healthy version of state capitalism. And, you know, the bit in the middle, the free market capitalism that we basically developed since the Second World War, maybe that's the odd thing out. And then when you think about it that way, you know, the free market capitalism doesn't look at the security of the state. You know, basically says, let's be efficient and let's just buy our iPhones from China if they're cheaper. And, you know, that's a classic economist point of view, isn't it? They're looking at a model they haven't connected with their humanity. They're a little bit spectrum-y economists. And so they've built these models that don't touch the real economy, and they genuinely haven't noticed. You know, you look at the FMOC framework, it connects to, you know, what I guess I'd say is lagging indicators, those price signals. And, you know, they really didn't notice, if you look at their calculus, that their industrial system was dying. They didn't notice that when a aluminium smelter closed down, that it didn't open again, because their models said that if the aluminium smelter closed down, it could just restart up and it'd be magic. Yeah, in the context of the aluminium smelter, the FMOC framework basically says that if an aluminium smelter closes down, and I can show people the calculus, if the aluminium smelter closes down, in the formula, it can just reopen wherever you need it, whenever you've got demand. But in reality, it's very costly to, you know, start the smelters again. The pots need to be basically jackhammered out. You know, it's a plant that has to be continuously run, or you can't really mothball them effectively. And that's happened right across the industrial economy. And what's interesting is that the mainstream Federal Reserve type economics that they follow didn't notice. They may have noticed as an institution, because obviously I haven't interviewed the individuals, but they didn't notice from a model perspective. And so to a great extent, they kind of rationalized the loss of industrialism as, you know, an ascent to value, you know, just learned the code bro kind of thing. And that ascent to value was, you know, you guys can do all the dirty stuff and we'll go off and do the value added stuff. And there would be this endless climb to the top of the mountain. We'd be just ahead of the people that we, and it's a flawed system. It's like, you know, rationally, if you sit back at it, it's a ridiculous system. Where were we climbing? We weren't sure. We just had an idea that if we climbed there, it'd be okay. And what's happened is that we climbed right into a financialized economy where the people who learned to code are going to be replaced. And, you know, all the economy below us was dependent on a foreign power. And that dependency opens up risk, vassalage of your 17th century serfdom, so to speak. If you can't, if a foreign, that's what Alexander Hamilton said to us, is these people, Eisenhower said the same thing. If you're dependent on a foreign power to run your economy. You can't. You can't literally fight back because they've got your supply chains and they've got your supply lines. And, you know, that makes a level of common sense to everyone. But we've lived just through a period where we've all become kind of groupthinked or thought into a process where we're reliant on, you know, in Australia's context, in America's context, even in India's context, we're reliant on foreign powers to do what we want to do. Freedom and liberty and all those things that people aspire to aren't just rights, they're conditions. And the conditions you need is independence, and that independence comes from manufacturing. So it sounds very logical like that, but we forgot it somehow as a civilization. You know, it's like tulips. You know, we kidded ourselves like the Dutch did into the fact that it was more valuable to do things in the cloud than it was to do things in reality. And what we're really seeing here now is a disconnection mentally from what I call big industrial metabolic systems. People think of the cloud and it's up in the sky because they don't know where it is. It's an ethereal thing, you know, ethereal thing. And it's really a very hungry metabolic system. It needs copper, it needs electricity, it needs water, it needs air, it needs all the things that you need. And if intelligence is going out to the edge, if there's going to be intelligence, you know, in your house, in your lights, in everything you come across, part of the metabolic system is having a system of a physiological system to the economy that supports all of that intelligence. You can't do it without copper. You can't do it without building these massive industrial systems called, you know, data centers and the power systems and, you know, the alternate energy systems and the old, you know, fossil fuel energy system. They all integrate together and they've got to be orchestrated. And you can't wait for a price signal that's 12 months lagging indicator to decide that you're running out of a substrate, that, you know, an input that you need supply of. You've got to do it immediately. So there's a different type of economy coming. There's a different type of economy coming that is much more beholden to that type of, I guess, orchestration. It has to be. You know, the intelligence is coming so that we can do it. But it also means that we need to be able to understand, you know, we need to get our copper forecasts right. We need to get our rare earths forecasts right. We need to be able to supply these components. You know, I think I talked earlier that you've got this titanium bolt concept that I was talking about with my car. You've got that across the whole economy. So, you know, when we go back to like link it across to the Straits of Hormuz, China's got that kind of economy too. And, you know, there's a realistic, you know, it's the end of globalization. It's the end of global trade. Well, it's not, you know, they're not all going to disappear. The $2.4 trillion worth of imports going into China sustains it because they can't make half that stuff. And yeah, sure, they export a lot and sure, it's imbalanced and sure, we have to orchestrate it better. And it has to become, I guess, you know, the handoffs have to be seamless and they have to, I guess, evolve into complete seamlessness. But there's only one humanity, whether you're Chinese or Australian or American, you know, or Iranian for that matter. And, you know, this ugly process we're going through, the brutal process, will eventually stream us all together. You know, I think the technocrats in Europe think they're going to stream us all together with, you know, one global government, the crazy people they are. And so that's a top-down effort, but I think this is going to happen from the bottom up more. You know, people are going to rediscover sovereignty. You know, there's other reasons for it. You know, and we're going to have to integrate those sovereign nations into each other. So, you know, if you look at as part of the same process, it's not hard to see how it's connected together. Now, obviously, we've got some political thoughts about how it's best done, and so maybe, you know, I mentioned the European technocrats, they want to do it from a top-down perspective, and, you know, I imagine a lot of your listeners probably think that's a bad idea. I think it's a bad idea. But, you know, it's going to happen in some respects. it already has happened in many respects. You know, we already have, I don't know, I was looking, I think we've got 140,000 ships, you know, cargo ships out there, bulk carriers. They have to float around the place. And guess what? They're going through the jugular vein of the Straits of Hormuz. And if you shut that down, they've all got to sail around the bottom. And, you know, some of those ships, you know, that's going to add fuel and oil and lag. You know, it'll if everyone has to sail around, it's going to make it very difficult. And so we're going to slow down the economy. But that's a natural evolution, isn't it? You know, like if you shut down the Straits of Hormuz, everyone all of a sudden has a recognition that Hormuz is pretty important to keep open. You can see this from a geopolitical perspective. No one wanted to get involved in the war until they realized that it was going to stop their country operating. You know, I think Macron is sending his whole carrier strike group there all of a sudden because he thought it was a better idea that they keep it open than they close it up. So everyone's going to help now. You know, we just have to pray for the people of Iran and, you know, I guess the war fighters are out there that are you know, playing to the instructions of their commanders, that they're all safe and as many stay safe as they can.
Craig, you know, one thing that is maybe misunderstood or often presented as this, in another way, a doomsday type scenario, is this advent of AI. You know, we've kind of peripherally talked about it, but do you think that it is justified for most people to be worried that AI is going to replace them and take every job, and now we're going to all have to somehow be subservient to a UBI type system?
Yeah, I think it's overblown. I think let's start off with the AI gurus, you know, whether we're Dario or all the others. You know, they have lots of meetings a week, I can imagine, and, you know, a lot of it is capital raising. So they've got to convince a lot of investors to put hundreds of billions of dollars into the system they're building. And so part of one of the business, you know, the pitch decks that would say is you invest $300 billion with us and we'll turn it into, you know, X revenue. We'll turn it into $400 billion worth of revenue. And so that revenue line has to be split down, right? Where are you going to get it all from, right? You're not going to get it from ad revenue. That doesn't make any sense. You know, it's not Google. It's not search. You're not going to get it from, you know, you're not going to get it from the software industry because let's look at SaaS. SaaS are already added AI to their products. If you look at, you know, all the nominated areas like accountancy and lawyers where they say functionally we can replace the lawyers in 5 minutes and, you know, 18 months from now on, everyone's going to, all the white collar workers are going to be out of work. Well, and they're going to replace the SaaS platforms. Well, the SaaS platforms have already added AI to their, you know, it's an option, you know, pay an extra $100 a month. Whatever the cost is, it's already integrated and there was an AI that was built by them, not by the frontier models. You know, that's the other thing is this is democratic in the corporate sense. If you want AI, like I think Salesforce have already invested $15 billion in AI. It's not million, it's billion. And they're one of the big SaaS platforms. I think Oracle, who's probably arguably the biggest SaaS platform as far as if you've integrated all their apps together and counted that as revenue, they're into the 50s and hundreds of billions of dollars invested. So this argument that AI is going to get rid of SaaS, well, you know, some SaaS might perish, it always does. But SaaS has already automated a lot of the stack. Now, you know, if you look at my background, I've been integrating software and getting rid of jobs for 40 years. So, you know, when I started out, we had punch cards and we had, you know, filing systems and there were banks and banks of filing systems, you know, with bits of paper in them. And, you know, when I finished doing that kind of thing seriously, most of it was automated. And I went through every stage of that. So to say that they're going to get rid of your jobs, well, it's been a progressive process since then. You know, if you walked into a bank branch when I started out walking in the bank branches to provide systems to them, there were dozens of people in there sitting at desks. And now you walk into a bank branch and there's a couple of tellers and a couple of people walking around trying to tell you the use of the machines instead of talking to the people, right? So they've really slimmed them down, and that's automation anyway. So this is the natural evolution of automations. If you look at some of, you know, one of the other things I did a lot of was outsourcing. So we outsourced application development maintenance. We outsourced our data centers. We outsourced our mainframes, and we gave them to companies who had a mixture of staff onshore and offshore. So, you know, there were Indian developers who have taken over the development of banking applications, and they're working from India because it's easier to aggregate their wages from India, and that lowers the cost. So they've a lot of enterprises already taken advantage of that stuff. So, you know, when they say, you know, we're not going to need application development coders, well, I say back, well, the products aren't ready yet. You know, they're pretty amazing, I agree. But you might be talking about Indian jobs getting rid of, not, you know, American jobs. I'd say that with accountancy too. I know a lot of large accountants, and my daughter works for a global SaaS company that does accountancy. So she talks accountants all day. And, you know, a lot of their back office has moved to India as well. And so the Indians do all the back office work, and the accountants, you know, rather than having 100 staff, have got 10 staff. So that automation has already taken place. So the accountants we're getting rid of are probably going to adopt AI from India. And so those will shrink, but it's not white collar jobs in the West. You know, you look at call centers, AI call centers are pretty nifty, you know. They talk to you. Like, there's a couple of times I've been talking to AI call centers and they completely fooled me. I was talking, and then you just notice, you know, a slight repetitiveness or something like that. And you go, oh my God, it's not even a person. And it was coincidental because all of a sudden Australian call centers were talking to me with Australian accents. And I realized that AI had taken over the call center, some of the call center functions, but that's from the Philippines. Like, it was already outsourced to the Philippines. So again, the white collar, the staff, you know, it might devastate Filipino call centers. It might not, but it's not in the West. And then you look at the life cycle of a lot of these businesses. A lot of these businesses, you know, you for instance, people say AI native. There's going to be a percentage of, especially young people, go AI native as quickly as possible. And they will eventually, I guess, cannibalize the other sectors. But there's a lot of boomers going to be in the workforce for a few years yet. And they're retiring at speeds that I don't think AI can replace them. You know, the aging demographics basically says at this pace, at this stage, you know, people are going to retire faster and faster and faster and faster. We've got incredible numbers of boomers retiring out of white collar jobs. And, you know, the reality is that you've got to offset one against the other. If you're saying AI is going to get rid of white collar workers, fair enough. I'd say, well, you know, I used to do, when I worked in software companies, I used to get, I guess, grilled every 2 weeks or every week sometimes about my team's performance against sales. They'd say, you know, what's your pipeline? Where is it in the state? Who have you talked to in the company? Have they signed off this person, that person? You know, so you'd be able to do a forecast. Now, the reality is that process of software review and reporting, the sales process, you know, surfaced, I guess, the friction of trying to get a company to swap from an old system to a new system. And we would get examined on it, especially, you know, the higher you got, the more time you would spend with management of the state, explain to them what your forecast was and how you were going to get there and all that kind of stuff. These AI gurus are basically saying, no, we'll just replace everyone down the track. And they're really talking to the capital investors. They're really talking to, they've not been able to swap roles. They can't walk out of a capital investment slide deck presentation to investors to get $100 billion and say, we're going to make humans obsolete in accounting, and then turn around to the market and say, well, no, well, that'll take us years. They've got to be consistent. And so what we're listening to is, I guess, people that have got an enormous amount of vested interest or capital in a particular outcome, and they're not reliable forecasters. They demonstrate they don't know much about the market they're talking about, and second, they don't know the institutional friction. You know, when I talk about boomers, you know, a lot of the time, and I spend a lot of time calling on enterprises, you know, 40 years basically, and these people are in charge of the companies that would replace the software that they're currently using, and the people who are talking to them are older as well, and they've got to the stage where they have to prioritize what they're going to replace and what they're going to spend their human capital doing in a year. And, you know, just the fact that they can replace their SaaS costs isn't enough. They need to understand the whole ROI. You know, how much is it going to cost them? Is there going to be risk? What's the security implications? How many people are going to need to be able to do it? So yes, you can code, you can vibe code things, and I do that, in ways you can never even dream of. But that doesn't turn into a system, and that doesn't turn into displacement of existing systems, because, you know, you've already got SaaS companies and ways of doing it. It's just going to take institutional friction. So I think what happens is the AI companies don't deliver the revenue that they're forecasting as quickly as they do. And Dario said himself, if they don't do that, they're dead. So you're going to see a lot of turnover and perturbation in AI world. You know, like, look at Dario decided he wasn't going to let the military use it the way they wanted to use it, whatever that meant, because I don't think that ever became clear. And OpenAI signed them up, you know, and Trump tells him that, you know, Anthropic is never going to be used by the entire government. That can't be good for your business plan. That can't be good for your revenue line. We can argue whether he's a moral actor or not. We can also argue whether he should be a moral actor. Like, at the end of the day, as I keep saying to people, it's not a consumer device AI. It's a military capability. And, you know, and as much as we might like the moral stand he took, or some people might like it, at the other end of the stage, you know, he is also the guy that's come out and telling he's going to replace all the human beings. And are people crazy? Like, are they going to be allowed to just replace humans wholesale and automate the planet? Like, you know, we've already had in New Jersey that guy that was walking around the street with the crowd saying that they're going to close down the data center in New Jersey, and then we've got a rash of them. You know, I don't think human beings are going to take too kindly to obsolescence. And that's going to, I think, slow the revenue line. I think this idea that we're all beyond, you know, universal basic income and we're all going to be replaced is ridiculous, because it ignores the capability that humans have of objecting. You know, you can see, you know, the political compass will change completely, you know, unless we're deciding to get rid of democracy at the same time. The political actors are not going to lean into it. And so I think they're doing a massive amount of stupid branding. You know, they if they're going to replace us, they should be a little more subtle about it. Yeah.
Well, Craig, you know, you've been talking about, or we've been discussing this idea of AI replacing people. And if that is a threat, how big of a threat it ends up being. But if we have, you touched on this idea of demographics, if we have a whole age group of people that are leaving the workforce, number one, number two, an entire skill set that is also leaving the workforce, is that almost in it, or can we consider it in some ways to be similar to that new balance that needs to be struck within this evolving world where AI can take the place of some of those or many of those people that are leaving the workforce to at least maintain productivity as we age out and lose that skill set?
Well, I think that's where it's going to end up. I'll give you one example, but there's dozens of them. The aging demographics means that, you know, as we know, lots more people are retiring now than retired last week or retired a few years ago. And I think we're at the peak, and, you know, that means retirement, let's call it 65. Some people are retiring later now, but let's call it 65. Well, those 65-year-olds are going to be 85 in 20 years. And that is a different level of care. You know, in Australia, I don't know the American numbers, but in Australia, we have 200,000 plus 85-year-olds. By 2030, we've got 400,000. Like, who's going to look after these people as they age into, you know, care requirements? You know, we're going to need these robots to look after them. I know I care for my mum a lot. She goes through different medical situations. She's pretty good at the moment. But we've been through some critical care moments. And, you know, the cost of providing people, you know, 24/7, and I'm capable of, you know, from a monetary perspective of doing that, but it becomes burdensome. You go do it yourself, and that's what you want to do for your parents anyway. As this multiplies, we're going to need assistance to look after these old people. And, you know, we've forgotten about that. And so, you know, when you're talking to these AI gurus, you know, I feel like talking to them and saying, hey, listen, I know you think you're going to replace all the accountants, but, you know, the aged care workers would make a lot more sense. And you may not have as many objections. Like, you can't imagine people demonstrating against robot aged care workers, you know? And so that's how the society in a more mature way might deal with it. It might say, well, we don't want you to replace the accountants, and we might still want them to, but, you know, say we don't, we can redirect that energy to, you know, robo taxis and the aged care workers and healthcare workers. And, you know, there's a whole list of things that we would want them to do and it'd be highly beneficial to do. And so we're having this argument twisted on us by the very people that want to drive revenue out of their product. They're not selling it in a way that I think is more practical. You know, they're selling it in a way that's, I guess, demonstrably bad for the society. And so that's skewing the points of view that, you know, we have on it. You know, if you go, I go to my grandkids' football match and you talk to the parents about AI, there's a surprising number of negative stories, and it's just, you know, going to knock down your rationality, and it's going to not help your thinking function for kids, and it's not going to, you know, it's going to replace all our jobs, and it's, you know, it's ruining writing, and it's ruining exams and learning, and there's all kinds of negative stories. And I've never seen, like, I grew up in the software industry, and I've never seen the worst marketing campaign in my life. Is, you know, what they should be trying to fashion the opportunities out of it rather than letting things happen in such a negative way. You haven't even got 8 people using AI properly because, you know, people talk to it in English, and so they think of it as a person, but it's really a programming language that just happens to be English. And you know, there's a lot of programming rules that you have to use for it to become effective. So it's getting a brand reputation of, you know, an idiot encyclopedia, where it should be getting a high, much higher brand reputation if you had people trying to use it. And so I see it as a business. It's become a business flaw of the AI developers that they're worrying about, you know, improving inference and not improving customer acceptance. Somebody showed me a diagram the other day of all the AI users and what percentage used it effectively. And it's like, you know, less than 1% of people are using it effectively. You know, the rest of them are subject to delusion. People don't understand that you can take the hallucinations and delusions out just by an act of programming, putting constraints on the AI. They don't know why it's happening, so they think it's the platform and it's just how you use it. But how many people, you know, that are listening to this actually know that? It's probably 1%. And so, you know, we're not actively learning how to use the platform in an effective way. And the reality is that's hitting the reputation of the platform. That's a lot of billions of dollars to invest in something that you're ruining the brand of. If it was toothpaste and it was getting a brand reputation like that, the brand manager would do something about it. But these people are, you know, seem to be on the spectrum and don't seem to understand the holistic nature of their product. And so they're not managing very properly. So they're getting unnecessary brand damage.
But is it maybe more of a case at this point of they have far bigger things to be focused on and trying to solve for rather than just, you know, focusing on the PR campaign?
See, they've got a complete AI platform. You know, theoretically, they should be able to handle the PR program really easily, you know, because, you know, you can basically build it with AI and deploy it with AI. So, like, it's a classic, you know, well, they're all too busy trying to grow the platform. Well, how come they're so busy? Why aren't they productive? Why aren't they managing all the components of their business? Because it's low touch. Like, I could literally build a PR program for, you know, any brand in the next hour. So I see it as a blind spot because they are focused. They're being humans and they're not focusing properly on the entirety of their business.
Well, and the other interesting part is that very few people actually pay for using any of these AI platforms either.
And so they get a crappy result. Mm-hmm. You know, the $20 platform and the $0 platform. I'm good. Like I'm on pro on it every thing, and I've got a programming background, and so I know how to use it. And you know, I've even got a swap between them because one platform's not enough. You know, you might prompt him on one platform and take that prompt to another platform, just because if you use the prompt on the same platform and don't tell it, it you get a worse result. But if you build a prompt on, say, Gemini and tell them you're going to use it on GPT, they work better. But depending on the application, you know, some platforms are better at writing and forming ideas. Other platforms are better at programming, like Anthropic is better than, yeah, and on programming, although GPT with their codec stuff is seems to have caught up. So you're jumping between these things, but they're commoditizing themselves anyway. You know, I don't know what Anthropic think they're going to do if they're knocked off the US government from their coding platform. And they don't know where they're going either. Like Dario wasn't talking about coding as his main business 12 months ago, and now it's his main business. So if he didn't know that then, what doesn't he know in the next 12 months? You know, like, and this is the thing, you know, they came out with, I think, the mainframe replacement story, I think Dario came out with, you know, and I've had a bit to do with mainframes over 40 years. You know, he's going to modernize mainframes. Well, there's almost no company on earth. Now, I'm exaggerating. There's probably 10% of the market still operating their own mainframes. The rest of them are outsourced. So the mainframe skills, and most of the mainframe skills are in India. So, like, and he's going to modernize the mainframes. Well, what do? They're 99.99% effective at doing ATM transactions, for instance. So why would you modernize that code? Well, you might want to stick some extra functionality on the end. Well, you can do that without modernizing the entire code base, because that's already, you know, we've already got systems of integration into mainframes that do that. And, you know, if you're going to modernize mainframes, they're all built by IBM anyway. You know, they've already got some, the IBM mainframe platform is Z. They've already got AI integrated into their mainframe tools. They've already done it. So Dario's not going to, you know, Dario may get onto a mainframe site, but, you know, he's building a product and he's hoping they come. It's like, there's a whole concept in product management, which is, you know, build and then they come. We're going to build a product. And, you know, I guess the greatest exponent of that has been Apple, you know, and they built products and people loved them so much they adopted them. Well, you know, Anthropic and GPT, or, you know, OpenAI, are just building products and they're hoping some of them stick. And because they've got this AI engine to build products, they can build them faster. Like, you look at OpenAI, stop picking on Anthropic. They've got dozens of appliances that they're going to release, you know, soonish, that haven't got screens. Now, you know, has there been a mass market test of screenless devices? You know, well, I understand the concept. You know, I've got something on my lapel and I keep talking to it and it starts helping me, and I've got something in my ear or something like that, and all of a sudden I've got, you know, a verbal cue on, you know, that's mobile, and I don't need my phones anymore and I just start talking to them. But that might take a few product cycles to work out. It may never become popular. It's like these AI glasses from Zuckerberg, you know. They're hard to use. I'm sorry. Maybe I don't want things in front of me, you know, little boxes and lines and things like that. Yeah, maybe that's not what I want to do. Like, I'm a technologist and I don't want to do it. So maybe other people don't want to do it. So, but I tested them out. I bought them. I played with them. I've got a whole cupboard of things that I bought and never used, you know, like drones. Like, I got into first-person drones for a while. And, you know, that was fun, but that hasn't come out for 6 months. You know, put the goggles on and fly through the trees like I'm in Star Wars. That was great fun for 5 minutes, and I got bored with it. And so that's going to happen in product cycles for everyone. You know, there's one in 100 stick, and, you know, maybe OpenAI do crack it, and we end up with appliances that haven't got a visualization component, but maybe not. And, you know, maybe these AI companies are flailing about. You know, the concept of the Dario comes across, I'm picking on him again, but this country of geniuses, you know, it's an interesting concept. You know, a country of geniuses are able to be used by anyone, but how many people need a country of geniuses? Like, how many businesses need a country of geniuses? They don't. It's like saying we're going to give you, you know, a huge amount of power. Like, you know, maybe I can't use it. Maybe I'm an accountant and all I do is people's taxes and I don't need a country of geniuses. I just need a tax accountant. You know, maybe I'm a bank and, you know, all I want to do is go and talk to a customer agent. I don't need a country of geniuses to do that either. You know, maybe this is not a product market fit in the context of, you know, the product versus the need. You know, maybe it's over-engineered. You know, the robo-taxi doesn't need to talk to you. You know, it doesn't need to, it, all it needs is to drive you from A to B. So when it gets there, maybe you don't have to further develop it. It'll get safer over time and, you know, there'll be marginal improvements. But once it's driving you somewhere, that's the product market fit. It doesn't need to go further than that. Edge computing and latency, and, you know, and a frontier AI computer that's not close to you, you know, has a weight. So you're going to need edge compute. You're going to need AI at the edge. You're going to need AI in your home. I think you'll end up with an Apple AI on your desktop, you know, and you probably end up with on your lapel pin eventually, and it'll walk around with you. But it may not need a frontier model. You know, maybe you train, you know, in a programming sense, the AI agents inside the frontier models, and then you deploy them in you know, on edge computers, in desktop computers, in your own on-prem type solution. Maybe the cloud was just a stage, and that's going to surprise everybody. But that those kind of surprises have happened right through the whole technology evolution.
Mm-hmm. Well, Craig, I think a good way to kind of summarize a lot of what we have talked about is a quote that I pulled out of one of your articles that I thought was just excellent. And it says that in 2026, the alpha belongs to those who understand that markets trade on emotion, but settle on physics. Energy, throughput, and constraint determine outcomes after sentiment has exhausted itself.
Yeah, I kind of like that. It's good that I wrote it. It's good that I wrote it. I think we're in for, you know, my short version of that is this is a reality check. You know, if we're going to build this metabolic system, and it's, you know, a metabolic industrial system, and it's not a light one, it's a heavy one, we've got to get our ducks in a row. We've got to orchestrate it. And, you know, the cloud, the old type of capitalism where everything was done in, you know, digitally transformed, so to speak, is going to fall back to that metabolic system. And if you haven't got the metabolic system, you're not going to be able to trade. So, you know, it's a rewiring of the system. And, you know, look at it, I guess, as a human nervous system analogy. Yeah, you know, we're building the human nervous system of the next form of capitalism. And that nervous system is evolving, and it's going to evolve in ugly ways. You know, it goes back to Camus. We're going to have to be less reliant on a single sea passage. You know, because frankly, that's ridiculous. What happened to us when that ship got stuck in the Suez? And this is the same kind of thing, although it's arguably much, much worse, because it's just not one sea lane. It's, you know, the whole entrance to it. And so, you know, we're going to go through this, but it's just evolution. Evolution's ugly. Evolution's brutal. Evolution's difficult. Don't expect it to be easy, and you won't be disappointed.
That's a good way to put it, and I think a good spot to kind of wrap up for today, Craig. Is there anything that you would like to leave our listeners to consider before we do?
You just don't put too much weight in people's predictions, including mine. The reality is nobody knows where this is going. It evolves. You know, I've been watching this for 40 years, and I don't think anyone got there, other than people maybe like Steve Jobs occasionally and things like that. I think Elon's got a good handle on things. He's proven, you know, prescient in his way of looking at the world and predicting some of it. But even him, you know, we were going to have robo-taxis 10 years ago. We still haven't got them properly. So nobody really knows. So have some trust. Get out in nature. Stop thinking about these things so hard. You know, thinking about, you know, more thinking is something that doesn't solve too much thinking. You know, we're going to go where we need to go, and, you know, go smell the flowers. Stop worrying.
Absolutely. Craig, of course, more of your writing is available on your X at C Tyndale. Craig Tyndale Substack, and of course your LinkedIn as well. Craig, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciated the two conversations and, you know, being able to stretch our legs a little bit and really dig into some far more wide-ranging conversations.
Beautiful. Love your work.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time.